Hello, 1971, room 106 B at 1:30 p.m.
I'm committee on the governmental reorganization that comes to order. We're hearing testimony on 1059, and Dr. Gaber of the Mental Health Division is our witness. Dr. Gaber, you're welcome to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's good to know that I'm testifying before someone over whose future I have some measure of control. Chairman, I passed out to you a fairly lengthy prepared analysis of this bill. I do not expect to follow that analysis in detail, but I would like to bring your attention to one or two, several of the relevant items that I've tried to point out in this analysis. And I've tried to look at this bill from three vantage points. One of the advantages to be derived from House Bill 1059. Secondly, what do I pick up as potential public or legislative acceptance of the bill as written? And third, I try to play devil's advocate in terms of problems in the administration. There's one particular point I'd like to bring out a little later time as to one particular sentence in the bill in regards to that. The concept of the Department of Human Resources potentially could be one of the most effective and efficient reorganizations in state government, in that the many agencies and welfare, mental health, vocational rehabilitation, employment, and so forth do have interlocking functions. Almost any person may and likely will require assistance or support either directly or indirectly from one of these agencies at some point in life. Of course, that support may be in the form of assistance for an aging parent, a handicapped child, or even the head of a family. So the human resource agencies do touch all people directly or indirectly. Most often that contact occurs when the individual's vitality or resources are low ebb. This fact alone renders crucial the matter of the form, the fashion, and some may say so, the art by which services to people are tendered. I want to stress that paragraph because I think crucial in the operation of an effective Department of Human Resources is leadership. The ability to pull together an enormously complex group of agencies performing perhaps more different functions than any other agency of government, involving people 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 employees with vast fiscal resources, with a vast backup in federal resources, with the state and federal legislation running thousands of pages. It is important that the opportunity for leadership in this department be made it available to the director, and that the director exercise the highest and most responsible degree of leadership. Given that, there are many advantages to be derived from a structure such as is proposed in this bill. And I know the committee has heard many of those advantages cited by other persons, as well as some objections that you have heard from some specific sources. Briefly, beginning on the first page, I have listed what I can ascertain as some 15 advantages to this organizational proposal. But I have not bothered to elaborate upon these since the committee has heard considerable testimony. Simply call to your attention items 1 through 15, the sharing and integrating of objectives, the tailoring and programs to achieve those objectives, the complementariness of programs rather than competitiveness, the avoidance of overlapping or duplication, the availability of continuity of service from one program area to the other, the improved information flow between program areas. And I think the next one is very crucial, the ability to shift resources to high risk or high demand program areas will be enhanced. We do know that in the human resources area, there are almost contagious things occurring. For example, in one particular area in Southern Oregon, As the weather affects the timber cut and the market affects the timber cut, the unemployment rate goes fantastically high. Along with that go increases in people applying for public assistance. Along with that goes terrible stress to people. Their mental health problems have become more severe. Sometimes they act out their problems in terms of antisocial behavior, and the correctional problems then become manifest. Obviously, the ability to shift vast resources to high demand areas could be a very decided advantage of this proposal. Next, the maximum utilization of federal funds, and I think you've had considerable testimony on this before. I'd like perhaps to give you an example of it later on. Group coordination, the opportunity to share office space, administrative resources, and special skills, elimination or merging of unnecessary or duplicative administrative systems, direct line of Act 52 and direction from the governor will be defined, high single level of responsibility, the commitment of program resources presumably should be more responsive to legislative direction. Last, a small but somewhat important detail, the drawing and negotiating of contracts and agreements between separate agencies may be reduced. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I would like to continue and then come back to give you one or two examples.
May I just interrupt you for 1 second? The young gentleman who just came in is from Ashland, and the Lee Johnson, and many of you young people in the audience are from his area. You want to bow or do you want to just wait?
I was thinking about hiding for being late.
I'll come back and give some examples and some of how some of these things could work. On the other hand, I tried to look at this bill in terms of some problem areas and some objections and to answer those objections if I could. And I won't bring your attention to all of them. I would hope that whoever carries the bill forward would take an opportunity to read those in some detail. I wouldn't call your attention to...
I wonder if you minded, Dr. Gaber, if whoever carries the bill on the House floor could plagiarize your analysis of the department and use your work here.
I have put it into testimony before you and hope that it will be of some help to you, and I'm just delighted if anybody wants to lift even one word from it. Question two, some will complain that there may be diminished opportunity for specific legislative control. We know legislative authority is jealously guarded in Oregon, and of course the lack of intermediate structure and the concentration of power in the director and the reorganization powers conferred under section of the floor of the bill do not receive this concern. However, legislative control can still be exercised through the expression of legislative intent, which is informally expressed in this state, and through the line item amounts in the appropriations bills, which are not transferable without specific legislative approval. Furthermore, approval of appointments of the director by the Committee on Executive Appointments is still one more control. I don't know whether the public will understand these nuances of legislative control, but these appear to be those which remain and should be the items of concern to members of the legislature. The next one, the possibility of political favoritism. Oregon, of course, has a proud heritage of avoiding political favoritism in agency programs. And I think this is one of the facts that has always made, for example, the mental health program in Oregon a desirable spot to locate. The bill in its present form makes all policy fiscal and appointed authority the responsibility of the director, etc. I don't know how to answer this question. I have raised it before the committee before. I simply call it to your attention as one of my identifications of possible problems in this bill. The next one, no expert levels of special advocacy, identification, or appeal. The clients of human resource agencies do have a need to identify whether a special advocate or their cause or condition. And I think for a time this will be a problem, but it will be resolved given the acceptance of a new organizational structure and the establishment of meaningful guidelines, rules, and regulations. And as most important, thoughtful and considerate responsiveness to the needs of the special interest groups would be the most effective way to ameliorate these concerns. Item 5, the director cannot effectively comprehend all the relevant information. This is some concern. An answer has been to compare the proposed Department of Human Resources to the Federal Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. I do not believe that the comparison is valid under House Bill 1059. In fact, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare has an elaborate and statutorily defined infrastructure of departments, services, agencies, and institutes. However, of course, the director of the Department of Human Resources could not be responsible. He could not be portrayed as knowledgeable about all things. He should be a person who has the ability to perceive program relationships and coordinate and focus activities. He can be sensitive to the issues without knowing the minute details. On page 4, item 6, I raise this as a question and I do make a suggestion. I raise the question of whether the Department of Human Resources, as so structured, may not meet the federal requirements for designation of state agencies to plan, coordinate, or administer federal programs. My judgment is that it will. I would suggest, second paragraph on page 5, it might be important to have House Bill 1059 reviewed by several federal agency representatives just to ensure that the provisions for departmental authority are consistent with federal requirements.
You want to elaborate that on just federal ATW agencies? Or?
Crosses over into other agencies. For example, the Mental Health Division contracts with the Department of Transportation with the federal government. Yes, it is. Very logical. Doesn't seem like it, but turns out to be. Primarily ATW, because the ATW grants awards specifically name it shall go to a single state agency or the single state agency. And sometimes it has a qualifying phrase in there, such as, quote, detailed state health officer, unquote. I would simply recommend that it might be very advisable to have staff from the regional office in Seattle view this bill and simply give it their stamp of approval of meeting the various federal requirements, because it goes into all of the nooks, crannies, and corners of ATW. And I think it would be unfortunate if we overlooked something in that regard. Going on to problems in administration, I took the viewpoint of the devil's advocate. I can't elaborate upon those there. I simply try to envision what might be the problem from the client's view, from the employee's view, from the administrator's view, and we'll spend some time on the director's view. Let me bring your attention to one item on page 6 under problems from the client's view. Will my needs be considered in the location of offices? The concept of common locations and shared office space for a variety of human resource programs aims at improving coordination and eliminating endless referrals from one agency to another. Now, this has many merits. But this concept, however, I wish to submit to this committee, could be disastrous if the offices were located to satisfy the agency needs or to reduce costs, rather than located to provide accessible service to the clientele. Furthermore, common office locations could turn out to be granite-faced state edifices, which could easily be repellent to the already frightened and helpless clients. I would simply like to add this qualification that this must be considered in the establishment of common office locations. The client's needs really should come first. I have tried to identify some of the problems from the employee's view. I suspect that there will be problems in employees trying to establish their new identity, their new loyalty. Within such departments, there will be considerable concern as to who they are going to be dealing with. Identity, loyalty, and specialty identification are important. So is the identity of the client or the patient that you work with. And it's important to know not only who you are, who you work for, and what you do, but also who you care for. Now, there are some people who just don't want to care for the mentally ill, or the retarded, or the alcoholic, or felon. And I think this concern must be given heed in the reorganization of the department, that it does indicate there will unquestionably be some personnel upheaval. Let me skip over now to page 8, what I consider the particular singularly most important issue, which I'd like to bring to the committee's attention. I tried to see, put myself in a position of that would be occupied by the director of the department, to imagine the worst that could happen. And I've presented you with that devil's advocate point of view. And I think a couple of them are important enough that I'd like to go into some detail. The director will have no statutory guidelines to which he can hold subordinates accountable. Guidelines will be verbal or by executive order, and some instances are going to be quite elusive, and I would suspect that he will have few clearly statutorily defensible arguments if he questions the accountability of the subordinate. That is the risk that you run in structuring the department this way. Second and most important, with all appointing authority will go all responsibility for all final grievance hearings, all disputed personnel actions, and all the responsibility for collective bargaining with all employee groups in all program areas. My interpretation of the way this is built is written is that the director can escape none of these responsibilities. The aggrieved employee or the collective bargaining agent can demand and can receive the personal attention of the director himself. The director has no defense against endless impositions on his time and attention. Statute provides that these rights and responsibilities cannot be delegated away over the complainant's objection. The particular phrase that I'm concerned about is page 3 of House Bill 1059, section 3, subsection 2, line 19, now lines 18 and 19. The phrase, the director shall appoint all subordinate officers and employees of the department. I, just before lunch, brought this phrase to Mr. Davis's attention and my interpretation of the implications for the director as being responsible for all grievances and for all collective bargaining. And he has now in consultation with the Attorney General's office to determine what is the interpretation of this particular line. I would suggest that it does need legal counsel to investigate that, because potentially it could completely handicap and completely tie down the director. If my interpretation is correct, I'm assured by my personnel officer, by my administrative assistants, by Mr. Haldrud, and by a variety of other people that I have correctly interpreted this particular section of the bill. However, I think we do need counsel opinion on that matter. With all program responsibility, we'll go all...
Excuse me, Dr. Gaber, do you have a recommended language to replace this?
Well, I, it's technical enough that I really think somebody more familiar with merit system law should do that. But basically, the director should authorize, he should, of course, appoint all his immediate subordinates, clearly. Authorize all other appointments, and the language usually used is he will authorize all appointments in all divisions, and the administrator shall appoint in the division. But the technical language is extremely important in this. As you know, 7,000 employees, there's a very high turnover in our employees. We average 33-35% per year. We have many appeals, we have many grievances, and I'm sure it's true also in corrections and welfare. It's not a very stable workforce. I personally can be, as administrator of the mental health division, can have spent 5 hours in a public employee relations board appeal hearing and lost the case. Or I think the department forgot that it's recorded when the appeal to the circuit court was remanded for another hearing. So there are problems, and they're very real problems from a practical point of view of a director who's got to run a mammoth department.
I think the wording you suggest is really what the intent of the bill is. We don't certainly intend to go on in the direction.
I believe so. The way it's written, there's no choice.
I think you're right. We intend to have each, like you, in charge of your own department. We have no intention of having a director to do it, interfere in hiring your employees.
I think in this case, he could have delegated the appointment, but he couldn't delegate the grievance.
Right. Okay, thank you very much. I'm not okay.
question, and I raise these other issues, with all program responsibilities, will all public grievances and appeals, perhaps, I'm not sure. With all program responsibilities, will all client appeals go, including informal appeals as well as those which require fair hearing procedures? I think the committee would want to know whether or not the statute would allow the director to clearly delegate such authority. With all program responsibility, will all legal actions against the department be directed to the director? Can he be personally subpoenaed in court and required to appear? I don't think he can delegate that away. Same thing is true of many of those sign-off authority on grants, contracts, and awards. It may be construed that the director will have to sign all of these. That is a practical administrative procedure, but I would wager, the way the bill is written, that he could be held responsible for those. Lastly, the director will need to carry an enormous amount of information in his head, and many public appearances will result in questions which, if answered inappropriately, could cause serious consequences. Now, if one knows in advance, one can readily delegate such appearances. However, I suspect there will be a high expectation by the public of precise information and detailed knowledge on the part of the director. I think an undue expectation. I do not envy the person who finds himself in the director's shoes under certain of the provisions of this bill as I interpret it today. Those are my condensation of the detailed report which is before you and is available. Going back to the advantages, I think one of the biggest advantages, of course, is the maximum utilization of federal funds. As an agency administrator, it has been our impression, our interpretation of legislative intent, that there was not a great rush in the state of Oregon to utilize federal funds. That if anything, federal funds were to be strictly controlled by the legislature, and that, for example, no agency can accept or even apply for a single federal grant dollar without first getting express permission from the emergency board. And the obvious intent of this is to provide legislative control over grant applications which may, not legally, but which may policy-wise trap the legislature into future appropriations which will be beyond their means. If, however, the intent of the legislature now is to aggressively seek and utilize federal funds, then one of the best ways to do it is to make this department and make maximum flexibility and flow of federal funds possible. And to give you an example, there are enormous resources under the federal Social Security laws which could be but have not been put to use in this state. For years, there has been provision of the Social Security laws that dollars, even coming from private sources, could be quote donated unquote to the state, matched 3-to-1 by federal dollars, and given back to private agencies to conduct child care. We are so far behind in the utilization of these funds that if Congress changes that law, as they have threatened to do and tried to do, our loss would be something less than $500,000 as compared to the state of New York's loss in one department alone of $59 million. We simply have not used federal funds aggressively. I could fund in the mental health program with a lot of wizardry, and we, I think, the various agencies have it. I could fund a sizable piece of the mental health program if I had the flexibility during the biennium to do this and had legislative sanctions to do it. But if every time we have to go back and ask for $5,000 and spend 5 hours just typing the thing for the emergency board, we will not be able to do it. I presume that if this legislature passes this bill, it will be the intent to achieve maximum utilization of federal funds. One example of the way this is done. During this past biennium, the staff of the Public Welfare Division and my staff, particularly myself and Dr. Domke in Public Welfare, decided that probably it was legal under federal law to use Medicaid funds to pay for the care of such people in our hospitals for the retarded as require somebody to get nursing care. And we work with members of the legislature directly, the fiscal office, and budget division. We finally, by means of telephoning all over the country, found out a way to do it. Passed a special bill, setting it all up through the emergency board. The net effect of that is that we now achieve 53.6% of the cost of caring for the patients at Fairview from federal revenue for those two patients who are eligible. And that is approximately 50% of the patients in that institution. It means that we had to invest some money, but the net payoff in the state of Oregon was $5 million this biennium. By using federal funds, we were able, in a sense, to reduce our general fund commitment by $5 million. Now, that took a lot of work between the agencies. It was a joint endeavor that at the operating level involved welfare, mental health, border health, executive department, as well as some peripheral agencies, special meetings of the emergency board subcommittee. But that kind of know-how can take advantage of the federal laws, which apparently are designed to encourage such activities. Stanley, I'm pleased to say that we did this so effectively and I think so well in accord with the federal requirements that I did have an opportunity to appear before the Senate Finance Committee, and we even got the Senate Finance Committee to change the Senate bill that was up before the Senate this last session of Congress to clearly define that this could be done, rather than to have left it in limbo. We were working on a loophole. Well, that's one example. Another example, the Mental Health Division contracts the Department of Transportation. We have received a federal grant in excess of $2 million from the Department of Transportation for highway traffic safety. Well, the reason it comes to the Mental Health Division is that it is focused on the drinking driver, who accounts for 50% of the traffic fatalities in this state and other states. The aim is to reduce the fatalities which occur as a result of drunken drivers. For the benefit of these young people here, when I went through the traffic fatality records last year, the first person who died in the state of Oregon was an 18-year-old boy who was killed in an automobile accident, dead drunk. The second one was a 19-year-old boy, he was dead drunk. Mostly it tends to be people in the age range 40 to 50. Well, anyway, we contract with the Department of Transportation $2 million. Most of that money is subcontracted out. We have subcontracts now with the City of Portland. We have subcontracts with the State Police, subcontracts with the Motor Vehicles Division. We have a subcontract with a private advertising agency to put on a, we hope, high pollution campaign of public education. We have another contract with Teaching Research, Division of Mid System of Higher Education, and they are developing and are going to evaluate a new curriculum for the high school students in alcohol and driving. For years, we've had a curriculum in our school that the Mental Health Division has designed, but we've never had a dollar to evaluate whether it was any good. Now, by using Department of Transportation dollars, we're going to get a curriculum that is carefully designed and evaluated. So we get spin-offs from the direct project itself. Another contract with the Portland Bureau of Police, the City of Portland, we bought them 8 police cars. So that additional patrol can be provided during the periods when drinking driving is extremely common, namely Friday night and Saturday night. Well, these are some of the things that can be done with federal funds if used imaginatively. You may also know that we appeared before the emergency board and asked for $250,000 to fund the special drug treatment program. This is in the spring of last year. Our appearance was ill-timed in that the coffers, I think Mother Hubbard just went to the cupboard and found it was bare. There was no money. That afternoon, after the emergency board appearance, when they did not deny the application or the allocation of funds, they deferred action because they thought the fiscal picture might look a little better later. That afternoon, I called Mr. Pete the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation said, Nick, you know where we can get some money for this program? He scratched his head a while and said, well, we might try so-and-so. He gave us two men, and we got two men, and they spent all Saturday, all Sunday, and all Monday, which was a legal holiday, writing a grant application. It's about 35 pages long, and that's for $250,000. We got that written by Tuesday night. The governor himself put that in his pocket. Wednesday morning, he appeared before the Administrator of Social Rehabilitation Services, and the next day, I leave to your imagination as to how we got the money to operate the drug treatment program. This careful pulling together of the various agencies and the connections and the right deliverer in this case really can pay off. Now, this is the intent of the legislature in this session to maximize utilization. House Bill 1059 will greatly enhance our resources to do that.
You have some suggestions in the last page. First, it says retain the designation of key operating divisions of the department.
Oh, I think that's really a moot question. I think if the reason I was thinking about that was this appointing authority thing. I think on the other hand, if you worded that the director authorizes the appointment, all authorizes the employment of all personnel, and the division administrators have the appointing authority, you'll probably start a problem. And then whatever division has is set up would have the appointing authority within its division and would effectively free the director to do something besides sit around and hear appeals. So I think that's moot at this point. I think any agency administrator not only is educated and trained, but he has to have a little ambition to get where he is. He needs to see the agency designation deleted, but after all, that's personal. It doesn't really have to do with the effectiveness of the bill.
I've had, in my account, a number of individuals, none who have worked for mental health, by the way, expressed concern about this bill. Not opposition, but concern, because I don't think any communication with families. I recognize that most of your people are in the same area. Have you attempted to communicate the proposal, the concept, the philosophy of the bill to people in your agency?
Not very well, frankly. We've had a lot of other fish to fry. This has about exhausted our communication capabilities, and I don't think until I sat down, you notice that my analysis is only dated January 25th, until I sat down and looked through this, until I really had a chance to talk to Mr. Davis today, it wasn't clear to me about certain things that I would have hesitated to interpret this bill. I have interpreted to my key superintendents and section directors. They all have been provided a copy of my former comments and will, after having been presented, they receive a copy of these comments and a copy of the bill. It will be brought up at our management meeting next Friday, superintendents and section directors meeting. We will interpret it this way, and I will have to rely on them to communicate to the other 2,800 employees in the division that they are located all over the state. Pendleton, Fidel, so forth. And community clinic personnel, we have met with the clinic directors. We have discussed this. I will make this available to them and will interpret it to them at their monthly meeting we have with them. I think they probably feel more threatened by this kind of thing than somebody who's supposed to see the government, because they are not positioned to really informal ins and outs of what's going on and to get a pretty firm grasp. It's very threatening to many people.
I really only have one comment, and I'm not sure yet whether it's a question or a comment. On page 6 here, you listed from the client's view and who's in charge here. And this is why I said I don't know whether I have a question or a comment. Some of the testimony that we received so far has shown us that there already seems to be confusion. one person visits one place and he's told to go someplace else, to go someplace else to see Mr. Smith who's in the next building. So I'm asking, don't we already have the kind of confusion that you're saying we might employ here if we cut this bill the way it's written?
We certainly do. No question that we have confusion. Person goes to the welfare office and they scratch their heads for a while and say, well, you really need to be over at DDR, and they get over and say, I don't know, you're pretty sick, you gotta go to the mental health thing. Now, one of the things you gotta be careful about here is that you just cannot expect a person of average intelligence and average education, which is what most of us are, to be able to know all of the complicated business of welfare, mental health, DDR, corrections. I have a heck of a time keeping track of just one field. And I have, lots and lots of years of education beyond college. So I don't think it's reasonable to expect that by calling everybody a member of the Department of Human Resources, that they're going to be able to answer all the questions. What may happen is just the opposite. They won't even know who to send it to. That you would have to be aware of. At least now they know you can say, well, I can shove it off in this piece out to the DDR. At least I've got that identified. Unless it's clarified here in the reorganization, this is a problem, and the client may see it as a nameless bureaucracy.
Are you advocating increased statutory definition?
I don't think it has to be statutory, but I think it's going to be very confused until the reorganization, in fact, comes about and is well known. There's going to be a great deal of confusion. You have to face that. Legislators are going to get letters of complaint. But it will straighten out during time. And hopefully it will be less buck-passing, less of a buck-passing game than it's possible to be today. And I'm not everybody a buck-passer, but the statutes allow you to be is a little safer to do.
Yes, one question, Dr. Gaber. I'd like to echo the comments of the chairman. This is excellent testimony. Even I can understand it. I appreciate that as a committee member. But I'm wondering, would you have any feelings? And let me ask you this first. Did you do any previous work on the development of the human resources concept, the department concept? Or
yes, I reviewed an early draft in February of last year and submitted to the Health Task Force an earlier report. However, at that time we were dealing with an earlier draft. I also have, at Mr. Davidson's request, to take a look at Hospital 1016 somewhat the same way as I have all agency administrators.
My question is,
I did testify once and had one of my staff members testify for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more than just a brief background you spoke of before you made out the testimony.
Yes, but the final bill.
What I'm really concerned with, we've heard a great deal of testimony from different agencies who want hours in, who want hours out, and all that type of thing. Do you visualize a weakening of the effectiveness of the concept with removal of any of these departments? Assuming you're familiar with this organizational structure. Or do you see an enrichment of the program possibly by adding other agencies to that organizational structure?
As far as, let me comment on these going across the board. As far as the special schools division is concerned, I think that the testimony has been presented that probably is best and most wisely placed in the Department of Education. We do find that there are some blind children who are multiply handicapped, and it's a question whether they belong in the schools of blind or Fairview. As a result, we've had switches of people back and forth, and kids coming from Fairview to a blind school for the day and from the blind school to Fairview for the day. The problem that we have today that this bill wouldn't resolve is the difference in the family responsibility laws. Child attending the school for the blind is not charged. Child in residence at Fairview is charged up to full cost depending on the ability to pay. So you can't take a blind kid and move him over to Fairview because his parents are stocked with a bill that they do have at the blind school. So no matter where that division is, we're going to have the same problem, unless the family responsibility statutes are conformed. And I don't know any reason why we couldn't do through the Department of Education exactly what we do now with special schools and agencies, the Office of the Governor, same thing. But that's the key problem, is the conformance of the family responsibility statute, not where it lies. I know there's considerable comment from members of the disability group or the blind. Seems to be it would be advantageous to have the Commission for the Blind, the disability group, similar to many others in this. Board of Health ideally should be in this. The bill as written, as I interpret it, makes it a splendid island of isolation, governed completely by a policy board, which has powers that can not even be affected by the director of this department. So it would be a splendid island of isolation as written today. OMA Board of Health is a very vital human resource agency. All of it, welfare, mental health, particularly welfare, mental health, and DVR, have numerous meetings with the Board of Health and must collaborate. Board of Social Protection is the same way. Now, what I would question is, if you go beyond the major ones, corrections, mental health, health, welfare, rehab, and employment, I think you begin to muddy the waters by getting too many things in there. For example, when they started this biennium, when the cluster of human resource agencies held a staff meeting, there were so many people there, nobody got to say anything. There were 60 people at the staff meeting. And that you can't manage when you've got to have that much representation. However, if it's all reorganized, if those agencies included under reorganized divisions, it might be much more manageable. When you try to cluster them as independent agencies, it was just an unmanageable mess when you try to communicate with everybody in staff meetings. I don't know that there's any real value in including a lot more agencies. I think the seven I've mentioned here are the really crucial ones. They're the ones with the money, they're the ones with the personnel, they're the ones with the agencies and institutions that really deliver the service. Most of the others are more or less peripheral, carry more or less peripheral functions.
Dr. Gamera, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your testimony and your outline. I know you're deeply involved with establishing branch offices in the local communities and the local level, and I hope that if this goes through the legislature, that this will help you and I too.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Believe you me, I felt the heat from out there. I know that's why I decided to reorganize.
Maybe we will start hearing some public safety. Committee Chairman Willis and so forth. You might testify in a particular area of the bill at this moment. I will be having a work session probably on Wednesday. Probably on Wednesday with Senator Dollar. Thank you all very much.
State and Federal Affairs Subcommittee on Governmental Reorganization meeting Monday, February 8th, 106B at 1:30 p.m.
Meeting of the Subcommittee on Government Reorganization come to order. The hearing today is on House Bill 1058. The first witness is Mr. Lundy. I mean Mr. Ulrich.
Wouldn't be the first time we've been confused.
If you want to get that blind light while you're walking around,
thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bob Oliver. I'm Governor McCall's legal assistant. I'm also his public safety assistant, and it's in that latter capacity that I'm appearing today comment on House Bill 1058. I won't review the history of the governmental reorganization in Oregon, but I would note that a Department of Public Safety first was proposed in 1961, so it's by no means a novel proposal. In his inaugural message, Governor McCall noted that he recognizes his primary responsibility to protect the lives and property of Oregonians. He noted that his authority in this area can be delegated, but his responsibility cannot. To play the director of public safety between the governor and these various agencies might seem somewhat inconsistent with that statement, but my judgment is not. At this very moment, several major agencies involved in this bill report to the governor and receive instructions from him through the governor's public safety assistant. Many routine actions are authorized by the governor's assistant. Major policy matters, of course, are decided by the governor himself. The heads of the public safety agencies all know that if they disagree with the assistant's view, then, of course, they can take resort to the governor to resolve this disagreement. House Bill 1058 would formalize this arrangement. The director would be an individual appointed by the governor, subject to confirmation by the Senate, who could be removed at any time at the pleasure of the governor. This is a somewhat reassuring safeguard, because in a position responsible for carrying out the governor's duties to protect lives and property of Oregonians, immediate and continuing accountability to the governor is essential. The Department of Public Safety would include as division two agencies, now constituted as independent departments. The Oregon State Police and the State Military Department would include the staff of the Law Enforcement Council and the Board on Police Standards and Training. Functions now performed within the Executive Department by the Emergency Services Division, and functions projected for the Law Enforcement Data System would be transferred into the newly created department. Other functions which would be assumed by the department would include promulgation of safety standards for school buses, now a duty of the Department of Education, a safety code for motor vehicles used to transport workers, now promulgated by the Motor Vehicles Division, and the duties of weighmen, now within the domain of the Highway Division. A number of these transfers may be controversial. At the very least, they will raise questions. Representatives of the affected agencies are here today, and they will be available to answer your questions with regard to more specific provisions of House Bill 1058 and to discuss the considerations pro and con. House Bill 1058, incidentally, would transfer the Oregon Traffic Safety Commission to the Department of Transportation. This agency now is within the office of the governor. The shift was recommended primarily because the new arrangement would parallel the National Highway Safety Administration's subordination to the Federal Department of Transportation. Our own Director of Transportation, George Baldwin, is closely involved with the operations of Secretary Balti's Federal Department of Transportation, and this continuing relationship would facilitate coordination of their respective traffic safety agencies. Some of the agency heads present today may ask this committee to consider amendments to House Bill 1058 in particular respect. If the committee is agreeable, then the suggested text of any of these amendments will be furnished in writing at an early time. Speaking generally, I have a number of specific comments of a general nature which I'd like to call to the committee's attention at this time. Paragraph G, subsection 3 of section 1, that's page 1, lines 31 and 32, authorizes the Department of Public Safety to make rules and regulations relating to functions vested in the department. Might not be inappropriate at this point to specify whether these rules would be required to be made under the Administrative Procedures Act. Section 2 authorizes appointment of a director of public safety. That's on the beginning at the bottom of page 2 and the first 9 lines of page 3. Consideration might be given as to whether the director should be vested with the powers of a peace officer if he's already not one at the time of his appointment. perhaps provision might also be made for the deputy director to exercise the powers of a police officer when he is serving as director, and of course if he is not otherwise a police officer. Section 3, on page 3, lines 10 through 19, authorizes the director of public safety to designate from among division administrators a deputy director to serve at his pleasure. I assume the deputy director would continue to serve as administrator of his division. But just to resolve any doubts, some specific wording to that effect might be put in Section 3. Section 6, on page 4, and about line 24, transfers to the department, to the director of public safety, a number of functions formerly vested in the governor under the state police law. One of these powers is ORS 181.050, which authorizes the state police, with the approval of the governor, to assist any other department of state government in enforcing criminal laws applicable to that other department. Now, since these activities of the state police might very well involve departments other than the Department of Public Safety, in other words, we're talking inter-department rather than intra-department, some qualification should be put on this power so that the director of public safety could exercise it only with the approval of the governor. Section 8, on page 5, lines 5 through 14, makes the superintendent of state police removable for cause, but does not specifically require a hearing, as is required under present law. The superintendent of state police believes he should be removable only for inefficiency or malfeasance in office after charges have been filed and a hearing granted. He is present to explain his reasons in more detail, but I would say at this point that the governor does concur in his proposal. Under Section 15, page 8, lines 5 through 24, the governor appoints an adjutant general. The adjutant general would be the only divisional head within the Department of Public Safety appointed directly by the governor rather than by the director. We note that this arrangement is required under Section 3, Article 10, Oregon Constitution. I have heard some comments that this creates an asymmetrical organization chart, so to speak, but as a practical matter, having worked with the adjutant general closely for a year and a half, I believe that this would not cause any particular problem under the Department of Public Safety bill. General Anderson, of course, is here to comment on this matter if the committee desires. Section 17 of the bill refers to military functions vested in the military department, military division, excuse me, of the Department of Public Safety. I recommend this as more appropriate language than is found in Section 14. Section 14 speaks of the Department of Public Safety succeeding to all the duties, functions, and powers vested in the state military department. Actually, these powers under Section 17 are being vested in the military division of the Department of Public Safety. And any objections that a transfer of these military functions to the Department of Public Safety might be inconsistent with the Constitution of Oregon or with the theory of the federal powers over the National Guard, I believe could be eliminated by redrawing Section 14 in the same manner as Section 17 now sets out this transfer. Section 22 on page 12 would abolish the Emergency Services Division in the Executive Department and transfer its duties, functions, and powers to the Department of Public Safety. Now, I'm aware of a measure proposed by the Ways and, I believe, by the Ways and Means Committee, which would constitute the Emergency Services Division as a separate department. This is urged, I understand, on grounds that as a separate department, emergency services would be more directly under the control of the governor than it is now as part of the executive department, or than it would be if a part of the public safety department. Now, in reality, the governor's public safety assistant rather than the director of the executive department, now furnishes guidance to the emergency services division in much the same way it would the director of public safety. If there were some natural catastrophe or widespread civil disorder which affected a substantial portion of the state, and we're talking here about a genuine catastrophe or a breakdown of law and order, both law enforcement agencies and emergency services personnel, possibly even the National Guard, all would be committed in dealing with such a situation. As a matter of fact, this is just what happened during the American Legion Convention in Portland last August and September, when it appeared that there was a threat of a catastrophic breakdown of law and order. All these agencies were involved. Now, having been an entirely separate department would pose perhaps more problems of coordination on the part of the governor than if they were in a single department being coordinated by one man responsible to the governor. Now, a new but vitally important function to be included within the Department of Public Safety is the Law Enforcement Data System. July 1970, the Emergency Board approved a plan for implementation of a consolidated, computerized communication system to provide message switching and access to records at the Department of Motor Vehicles and the National Crime Information Center on a completely automatic basis to all Oregon law enforcement agencies. The speed up in response would be great. Instead of taking anywhere from 10 to 40 minutes to get information, the information would be delivered to the local law enforcement agencies in a matter of seconds, to the officer in the field perhaps 3 to 6 minutes, depending on local procedures. Plans have been prepared and funds requested for the next biennium to allow implementation of the next phase of the law enforcement data system. Centralization of law enforcement information at the state level, which would eliminate the need for duplication at the local level. In my view, the Department of Public Safety is the single agency which would best be in a position to assume responsibility for gathering, preparing, and disseminating criminal justice statistics as required by the participating agencies. One result of this would be that the Oregon State Police and local agencies then would have equivalent access to the resources of this system. Neither the local agencies nor the Oregon State Police would be placed in a position of dependence on the other. Now, in conclusion, I apologize for taking so much of the committee's time, and I would be happy to answer any questions of a general nature on House Bill 1085. If there are questions of a more specific nature relating to particular functions which are involved here, then agency heads and staff personnel with specialized expertise are here and can respond to the committee.
Thank you very much, Bob. Other questions, Mr.
Holmes? Only one. I noticed on this organizational structure that the Department of Justice is under this one. Has this been kicked out since this was drawn, or what's the position of the governor on this?
Well, there was a the legislative orientation conference, the Attorney General mentioned some proposals which had been made that there be what might be described as a super department of public safety, headed by an appointed Attorney General rather than an elected Attorney General, which would incorporate the Department of Justice within it. There were even suggestions that the local district attorney might be removed from an elected position and made appointed officers within the Department of Public Safety. At this particular point in time, the governor is interested in House Bill 1058, which was prepared by Mr. Engel's task force committee.
Do you have any reasons for opposition to this bill?
Well, I can't think of any reason for opposition. Are you asking me to suggest why others might be opposed to it?
Are there any bad points in it? That?
I think that some people might object to it on grounds that have been expressed against a number of other reorganization proposals. That is, perhaps putting too much power under one state officer. that might very well occur to many who are particularly sensitive about the law enforcement area. I don't think it really does that because they're all subject to gubernatorial direction now and to coordination through one governing system now. This was simply refined and recognized as existing structure and permitted to operate in a more effective way. There are, I have information that some of the specific proposals in here have been subject to question. For example, as I mentioned earlier, I believe that there are those who feel that the Emergency Services Division should be a separate department of state government, directly under the governor, rather than within the Public Safety Department. It's possible that, although I don't know, the Board on Police Standards and Training has not yet formally taken action on this bill. It's quite possible that they might have valid reasons for not being a part of the department, although I don't know what those reasons are at present. And I have heard rumors that there are those who do not feel that the Waymasters should be moved under this Department of Public Safety. I believe some of the people here today may have comments to make on that.
I'd just like to know if, as everybody testifies, what opposition, if any, that there is.
I'm looking forward to hearing some of it myself. But I'm sure there are valid reasons against it. We happen to think there are more compelling arguments in favor of it.
You said this type of move was first proposed in 61?
That's correct, by Governor Hatfield.
Can you very briefly tell me what has happened between 61 and 71? Why nothing has been done?
Well, in 61, Governor Hatfield proposed very extensive parcel of bills. There were seven or eight for creation of the Department of Social Services, the Department of Public Safety, Department of Natural Resources. None of those passed at that time because there were many who felt this was, well, it had always been done the old way, and this would put too much control in the hands of a limited number of individuals. In other words, they didn't approve of the cabinet system of state government. The breakthrough here came, the first breakthrough, in 1963, when the legislature approved formation of a Department of Commerce on a temporary basis for 2 years. The Department of Commerce consolidated a number of licensing boards, the banking division, the insurance division, the real estate division. The legislature in 1965 came back, reviewed the operation of this agency, and put it on a permanent basis. See, Mr. Kennedy, was that in 65 when they made it permanent, or 67?
It was passed in 63 or 65.
I think it was 65, right, that was made permanent. In 69, the legislature, on the recommendation of Governor McCall, consented to the formation of a number of other reorganized agencies, which included the Executive Department, the Department of Transportation, took the first step in what we hope will be an evolutionary process toward the Department of Human Resources. So the reason I think that it did not receive extensive consideration in 61 was at that point the concept of governmental reorganization looking toward a cabinet form of government was new. It hadn't been tried. There was no experience behind it. There is a considerable amount of experience now before us with regard to how this works in the case of other agencies. We believe that experience is of a favorable nature and that it can well be applied in the case of public safety agencies.
Do you have amendments prepared for these things you brought up?
We don't have them prepared at present, Mr. Chairman, but we will have them prepared promptly if the committee wishes.
Relative to safety regulations for school buses and the transfer from education to Department of Transportation, do you have any comment on that?
Sir, I didn't attend the House Task Force Committee meetings when it was decided to include those in the draft. There is an apparent, one might point to an apparent inconsistency in removing traffic safety functions from this area and putting them under the Department of Transportation while moving in other apparently analogous provisions relating to these safety standards into the Department of Public Safety. I think that one can explain the Traffic Safety Commission move as one to place it in harmony and parallel with the federal structure, not just because we're dancing to their tune, but because it's really a federal program that they administer. And for that reason, one can argue it should parallel the federal structure. In the case of safety standards for school buses, migrant vehicles, we think really these two functions are closely akin to each other. The same type of specialized individual would be knowledgeable in both these fields, and rather than have them split between two other departments out here, by bringing them together, we can have a more centralized staff, which would probably promulgate and see that these regulations are enforced.
In the bill, the Adjutant General is the head of the department. Is there any problem with this, federally or otherwise?
We're advised there's no federal problem here. The Adjutant General would, of course, have to continue to be appointed by the governor. That's constitutional, and it cannot be varied by statute. In that respect, one might say that I suppose it would be naive to suppose to assume that the Adjutant General would not continue to regard the governor as his primary boss. But on the other hand, I think there's some background of experience to suppose that there could well be a more effective coordination through a director of public safety. The whole point here is that if the governor, the adjutant general, and the director of public safety get along together and want to coordinate and want to carry out their common mission, this will happen more effectively under this bill than just under separate lines of authority. Now, of course, if they don't get along together, then this can't be done under any sort of structure devised by the mind of man.
The fact that they're sitting together, does this have any significance?
We think they would work together in great harmony.
If any more questions, Mr. Allen? Thank you very much, Bonnie. Jim Lennon?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am General Don Anderson, Adjutant General of Oregon, head of the Oregon Military Department. The Military Department has not opposed the Department of Public Safety at any time that such a proposal has been made before the legislature. We realize the desire of the Chief Executive to reduce his span of control within state government and support that desire as realistic and a worthwhile goal. Each time a Department of Public Safety has been before the legislature, we have been asked to comment on the bill while it was still in draft form, and each time our comments have been evaluated and integrated into the final draft. We have been appreciative of the opportunity to contribute to the preparation of House Bill 1058, as it was being considered by the House Task Force on Government Reorganization. Our suggestions have been incorporated into the bill, and we are satisfied that it is adequate in its present form insofar as it concerns the military department. With me today is Brigadier General Farrell Austin, Assistant General Hare, who worked with the Task Force Committee and your legal counsel in the preparation of the military department portion of this bill, and we'd be very happy to answer any questions that you might have.
I was going to meet a general with a uniform on. I wanted to see what those stars really look like.
This is a former National Guardsman.
I've been over to see a couple of
them.
I never did get to see one live and in color. They wouldn't let me that close.
Are there any questions, gentlemen? Or any regular? I might make just one or two off-the-cuff comments on some of the things you're talking to Mr. Oliver about. I can't see any great problem arising between the Director of the Department of Public Safety and the Adjutant General. It's like any other chain. If the people don't get along, one of the others is going to have to go. And I think that they can get along and I can get along. It would appear from the way we discussed the bill and the task force committee and now that the primary chain of military control, and I'm talking about the guard and guardsmen, not as a state agency, but military deal now, still would rest with the governor. And in the case of a flood such as 1964 or the hurricane in 62 and the American Legion, the control and command would be with the governor. But the day-to-day operations of the military department, the multitude of things that come up with 7,600 people, this would be directed by the director of the Department of Public Safety, and I think it will work out very well.
Thanks very much, Henry.
Mr. Hoffman?
Mr. Chairman, we don't. I'm the superintendent of the state police. I don't know if it's not everyone. Like the Adjutant General, we do not disapprove of this bill. We've gone over it many times with the Executive Department, and although we have some amendments that we would propose, we can see no problem with the Florida State Police Department concerned operating under this public safety setup. Some of the things I had here were mentioned by Mr. Oliver, and I'll skip further over that. And one minor change that I think might benefit would be on page 5, Warrant 91620. This is in regard to the Board on Police Standards and Training. Mr. Kennedy, and we remember that when this board was originally set up, the Deputy Superintendent of State Police was the Executive Director of the old law. And at the time that this was changed or amended, and he was removed at our request because the job became too great for him to handle the job. I think it was probably an oversight that the State Police was left out as far as the law is concerned of being a member of the board. And I would suggest that starting on line 13, that the law, where the law designates members from city and county law enforcement units, that include a state police officer in that area. I might mention that since this board has been organized a few years ago, there's always been a state police officer on. We've had no problem. We work very closely with them and in our training and so forth, so I think it should be.
Where is that, Molly?
Maybe I picked up the wrong page. Page 6, I guess it is. Line 13. I'm sorry, I hit the wrong page then.
Okay.
You'll note there it includes the members of the city and county law enforcement units, and I think the state police should be included there. My next comment, Mr. Chairman, would be in regards to the transfer of the Waymasters from the Highway Department to the State Police Department. I think the way the bill is written now, that this wouldn't do much good. In other words, I don't think the State Police would be in any position to do a better job than the Highway Department is accomplishing at this time. I would think that the primary reason for transferring Waymasters from the Highway Department to State Police would be to provide a more effective enforcement of laws not only with the regulation of weights and sizes, which they do now. But also, possibly should have the authority to issue citations for other types of violations, such as PUC violations and some parts of the motor vehicle code, like lightning. I think it would be much more effective. I think that sometime in the future, this consideration might be given to making these people full-time state police officers, rather than just transferring them over to civil service employees without the authority to act except in certain designated violations. I think possibly that Mr. Underdahl or someone else will comment on this more, but if there's any questions that I might be able to answer, I would attempt to do so.
In terms of Waymaster question, you don't see any particular advantage of transferring them to the Department of State Police unless they're given additional responsibility.
That's right, right.
Would it present a problem transferring these people to your department and giving them additional responsibility in relationship to qualifications?
Yes, sir, it would. I have some information here that we gathered earlier. It might have changed a little now, but I think it's about the same. There are approximately 75 employees now under the Waymaster. They're authorized at the minimum. Their equipment, of course, they use consists of 59 stationary scales and 30 sets of portable scales. They have some two-way radio equipment and all these things, of course, to be transferred over. Their vehicles, 51 vehicles consisting of pickups, trucks, and sedans. And if you, in order to do the same job, with the same number of state policemen, it would cost about, at this time, it would cost about $89,000 more than the present Highway Department budget for Waymaster.
How many personnel?
If we transfer them all over, it would be 75.
75 people. $89,000 additional.
That's what we had figured before. I haven't checked that in the last couple of months or whatever I have. There's another problem that you brought up. The average age or the age of these people, only 18 out of the 61 that they presently have, the field people, are under 45 years of age. And 43 are over 45 years of age. So when you're talking about making police officers out of these people, you run into that problem. Of these, about 31% have some form of a physical disability, we're told, that would ordinarily prevent them from being accepted as regular members of the department. I think if they're brought over, that they remain as waymasters at the present time and given some other added power, for instance, to make arrests on PC violations and perhaps the violations of the truck licensing law. They are permitted to write citations for those violations.
Is it practical to give these people limited additional power so possible?
This is what they have now, some limited power. What you'd be doing is just increasing that cycle.
That's practical.
I think it's been working with them, as far as I know.
I was speaking of the additional power.
I don't think that would create too large a problem because, for instance, on PUC violations now, these people have a phone available or a radio available, which they do usually, and they will call a state police officer if they did observe a violation of PUC regulations and were able to get them, but they're not always available. And that's why I think that if we're going to bring them over, they should have the authority to give it right out the citation for those types of violations. And of course, they'd be very simple to train them in, if they need any, in lightning violation control. Put them in place, they don't have the power to handle them.
Well, you would like to, or you do take most of your officers off the road at 8:45. What happens to them then?
We take the ones that are, and most of them are physically incapable about that time of operating on the fast highways. We either put them on the other highways where the traffic isn't as fast as some of other than freeways. And of course, we have quite a number of people that are operating as dispatchers in our radio stations during the night shift. In addition to that, we have quite a number of people who spend almost their entire time picking up driver's license and motor vehicle license. And we assign the older people that kind of job. Some that are capable are put over in the criminal section and are made in our investigators, criminal investigators, the ones that show an inclination for that type of work. This Waymaster thing came over in the state police, and we did use state police officers for this type of thing. We would have another place to put these people before they arrive at retirement.
What is retirement age for?
60, but you're not allowed really to set a policy on retiring even 60.
Doesn't California use this type of system? Don't they use their regular officers for?
I think they do. I'm not sure, but I think they do. We of course used to do all the way many years ago for the highway department, and we still of course do some of it, but not very much.
Question. If I understood your comments correctly, you say it would cost an additional $89,000 to incorporate the Waymaster job into the state police department now?
No, if we made state police officers out of these people, the higher wages and so forth would bring the cost up to about $89,000 more for the buy-in.
It would be the salaries then?
Salaries mostly.
Any more questions? Well, thank you very much. Yes. Mr. Bethel? Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I'm Paul Bettio, Executive Director of the Board on Police Standards and Training.
Bettio?
Bettio, right? Our board has not had the opportunity to take any formal stand on this legislation. However, I feel that they would be in support of it. Maybe one or two of them might have some hesitation. As far as Mr. Holcomb's remarks about including the state police in there, I'm sure that all of them would agree with this and think that it should be. It might also be, we might also include a member of the FBI. Ever since our board was organized, there has been an FBI member in there also. That's just a matter of information.
Particularly for the benefit of our new members, would you explain the functions of the police standards and training?
Our board sets minimum standards for police recruitment and police training. This includes all city and county police, particularly from departments of 1,000 population and over. We set the standards for what we call recruitment or employment, which means you must be 21 years of age or older, have a physical examination, a doctor saying that this man is physically fit to be a police officer, have his fingerprints on file with the Oregon State Police, and no felony records showing conviction showing against the man. A thorough background investigation is made to determine this man's fitness to perform the duties of a police officer. Generally, those are the standards for employment. Then, after the man is employed, within the first year, he must attend and complete at least 250 hours of basic training. This is normally done at one of the Oregon Police Academy, which is also under our direction, or one of the other police academies that we certify and approve their courses. Salem, Eugene, and the Metropolitan Portland have academies that aren't certified by us. The only area that, or one of the areas that our board does bring up at times that should the state police ever come under the Police Standards Act, and they're not under it at this time, but some states do include the state police, we would be more or less a licensing agency within an agency, licensing people within our own agency, and there might be some kind of a conflict here. This is not proposed, and it's not known that it will be proposed, but it is mentioned within our group.
Are there any questions?
Approximately how many employees are there? State employees?
On our staff? Approximately 7 full-time state employees and approximately 6 or 7 or about 4 federal employees, our employees on the federal grant.
Okay, I guess that's it. Thank you very much. Would the lobbyist for the county sheriff care to testify on this thing? We have a few people here from the, who would like to object to the transfer of the school bus drivers and so forth to the Department of Transportation. Ken, I think I'd like to hear them before we have you. I don't have a sign-up sheet on your people.
Doug Ole, superintendent of schools in Sweet Home. We run 28 buses down there, and we think instead of objecting, we would like to have the committee look seriously at this transferring from the Department of Education the responsibility of pupil transportation for several reasons. One is, I think we ought to take a look at the record. I think in 1961, the legislature made a change from a multiple supervision of authority to the Department of Education, and since that time, it seems to be quite satisfactory. We have some 2,600 school buses in the state of Oregon. We're transporting some 231,000 students, about 25 million miles a year. And I think if you'll look at the record, it pretty well speaks for itself for accidents and safety of transportation. Cost about 41 cents per mile. And I think there's some things that go on in transportation of pupils that are pretty important. One of them is that we feel education starts when the youngsters leave home. And this is part of our responsibility. And the State Department has been very cooperative with us in working on our transportation problems. They've left the responsibility pretty much to the individual school district. We would like to see this committee consider this pretty carefully before they make this change. We're not objecting to the new organization or anything such as this, but we wonder why it has to be moved from a department that is quite successful in the operating of the school buses at this present time.
Is it old?
Old, yes.
Any questions for Mr. Old? Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Are there other people who want to be heard on this particular part of the bill? We hadn't really scheduled here the, I expect to have a further hearing on this particular section, probably next Wednesday, week Wednesday. And I've already had some communication. I know there is some strong feeling about this among some of the people in the state. If there's anybody else to be heard on this section, we'll hear you now, and then we'll, if not, why, Mr. Underhill, will you take the podium, please?
Thank you.
Bob, do you have copies of your testimony that we can have for our file?
Yes, sir, I do.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I've just handed you an IBM printout on the Waymasters and their age and how long they've been on the job. The number is that there are 64 people employed this last week in the program of varying ages in there, and just a piece of background information. The essential background for the recommendation to include the Waymaster program, the Waymaster activities in the new proposed Department of Public Safety.
Time.
I can't
read the damn
thing. I know we have one person born in 1809.
The left-hand column is the agency. That's 734 is Highway Department. The next is the classification. There are three classifications, 1051, 1052, and 1053. Waymaster 1, Waymaster 2, and Waymaster 3.
How much does ink cost?
The third column is the first two digits are the year. The second
year?
Two digits are the month.
Oh, like
19. Oh, come on, Ken.
The first item is 19-8. The month is April.
04.
The last column is the appointment day, year, month, and day of the month. Mr. Chairman, the basic reasoning for the inclusion of the Waymaster program, I would suggest, is grounded in the recommendations of the Management 70 Task Force, the team which looked at the level of law enforcement and its effectiveness in the Public Utility Commissioner operation. Rather than my just regurgitating their findings, I thought it would be better to have Mr. Bob Page, who was the leader of the task force team that studies the Public Utility Commissioner and the enforcement of its laws and the interaction of the Waymaster program comes before you and testify on that material himself, and he's here with your permission. I'd have you call Mr. Page.
Why don't you
put
another chair up there and stand there.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Page. Our concern in the PUC area regarding motor carrier operation is whether or not we felt the laws were being adequately enforced. And we concluded generally that they're not. In this area of weights and measures and Waymaster operation, we felt very strongly that that should be incorporated along with other investigative type actions in a combined division of motor carrier inspection and organized under the Department of Police in some fashion. The reason that we felt that this should be done was that our solution to the problem was one of a truck driver audit. In other words, the laws and regulations governing motor carrier operation are so extensive that it really takes more than one person to ensure that the laws are being properly enforced and that this could more properly be done by a police officer and one or two additional people in a tie-up of a vehicle and the auditing of it from the front bumper to the rear bumper. And that is checking the license driver, the commodity class coatings of the cargo being carried, the authority of the truck driver and company to operate within a particular area, the weight, the safety of the vehicle, and all aspects of it. In addition to this, we found that the average fine being paid by the motor carrier industry for various offenses, primarily in the weight area, has gone down by 18% in the last 5 years and is at a level at the moment where it's not even an effect. effective deterrent to the proper enforcement of these laws. It's down to around $25 or $30 average fine. So we support this moving to the extent that it be done. Let me put it this way. We don't believe that just moving the Waymaster to the Department of Police is effective. And we support Mr. Holcomb's comments in that regard. We feel it has to be much more extensive than that and be inclusive of some kind of a truck driver complete audit of the function that vehicle is performing and its relationship to the laws written for it.
Oh,
yeah,
there's
one.
Lee?
No, I don't.
As you mentioned, there's been a drop in the percentage of fines. How did you arrive at that point?
Well, we asked the staff to collect information for us, staff at PUC. And they collected it for us. We had collected preliminary information before and finding out the amount of fines and the number of fines paid through various local court systems. And then we had them follow up and collect the additional data. Now, we did make a recommendation along this line, and it's in the PUC report, and that's just this, that the state used to have a minimum fine schedule for overweight situations, and it can be, and I assume was, developed very scientifically with the knowledge of what an overweight vehicle will do to a certain kind of road surface for so many miles that it travels, and the tire size and the number of axles and quality of the surface of the road, the kind of surface of the road, and so forth, is all taken into consideration. Later, that was changed, putting a suggested fine limit, or perhaps it's a maximum fine limit, on those kinds of violations. We find now that the local judicial system ends up assigning a fine of about half the statutory value, and even that is dropping. So in this inflationary economy that we have, this is one of the best buys you can get. And the first carrier industry has doubled in the last 15 years. So in looking at this fine schedule, we feel that the judicial system is not qualified for say whether the fine ought to be $400 or $50, but it should tend more to say what the aspect of whether an individual is guilty or not guilty. One glaring example that we found was an overweight situation in one county where a ticket had been written for $435 and meant $435 and mitigated down to $35. And we just don't feel that that's a fair situation.
Just what can Waymasters arrest for?
Weights and measures.
Weights and measures only.
Yes.
If there's another violation, then they try to get a hold of the state policeman if they can.
That's
correct. The truck's loaded with mortars, machine guns, and ammunition, and hashish. It's too bad.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, well, we were told, and we asked employees about this, if they had the authority to open a sealed truck. And they said they suppose so, but they do not open sealed trucks. If the truck is sealed, it stays sealed. And we felt again and made a recommendation that sealed trucks be opened, be investigated, and resealed in the presence of an officer. And again, a good reason to have a police officer present. Reseal with a state seal.
You notice I avoided black powder. Would it be possible from your study of this situation to make the changeover through attrition?
Well, it depends on how long a period of time that would suggestion. I think there are probably some people in the Waymaster group that could legitimately become police officers. There's definitely a changeover period needed because there's a training period for the police officers, and these men can help, you know, decidedly in that area. In addition to that, I think that if the truck driver audit concept were adopted, where when the truck is tied up, that truck is looked at from every point of motor carrier law that the state has affecting the operation of that vehicle, it's almost impossible for one man to do it. It's very involved and very detailed, and we kind of felt that it was necessary to have two, probably three people involved in the tie-up of that vehicle. But then if the minimum fine schedule is set at a sufficient level and followed up on, I think the deterrent will be enough that the cost of the law enforcement activity in this area can be reduced tremendously.
Would you think, Mr. Page, that should come into the same bill?
Yes, definitely.
In your statistical analysis, did you find a decrease in the number of citations being issued?
Yes.
Also,
yes, decrease in the number of citations, percentages down, dollar amounts down, sightings by state police for PUC down. In almost every case, the numbers were down, but in every case, the percentage and the size of the industry was down. But these average fines is the thing that really disturbed us, and that was that the fines in all cases were dropping percentage-wise, some down up to 18% in a five-year period, while the size of the industry is growing considerably. And most of the fines were $25 to $42 as an average fine. And this represents a nuisance overhead to the motor carrier industry and provides no deterrent at all.
Is there any indication at all of possibly more compliance by the motorists? Would this be a study for into this, perhaps this would be the reason that there was a decline in citations?
On the contrary, my personal opinion is that was not indicated at all. I would say that generally we found the industry looking at this as an accepted thing, almost a joke. It's not common to Oregon, it's common to the United States. I visited another state and talked to the people operating the jump scales on the road, weighing trucks. They pretty well confirmed this. It's an accepted thing, for example, to overload. The procedures have not changed for a number of years. Substantially for 15 or 20 years, and so, you know, the procedure is well known, and the system has worked. When members of the industry and drivers will freely admit this to a task force member in a conversation over a cup of coffee, we know that it's beginning. It is out of hand. I truly believe it is.
Chairman, I noticed in your report the number of arrests by state police relating to motor carrier statutes also dropped. Do you have any comment on that?
Excuse me, I didn't quite hear you. The number of arrests by...
The number of arrests on the part of... There's no explanation but table for state police enforcement activity, motor carrier statutes. The number of arrests has dropped to about too many from 65 to 59. From 2,104 arrests in 65 to 1,955 in 1969.
I personally believe that one of the reasons that it's dropped is because the state police officer is aware that it's hard to get a conviction in this area, and when he does, it's likely to be litigated down to half the state. statutory fine value, and so, you know, why do it?
Can a motor vehicle travel through the state of Oregon without ever stopping at a Waymaster?
That's correct.
I don't know how you do that, we won't spread the word.
They already know.
I know. They're very aware of when the stations are open and when they're not, and in some cases, there are telephone numbers that a truck driver can call to find out if a certain way station is over, thereby letting him know whether to stop for a cup of coffee or spend the night in one town or another town and then move on. It's a very accepted practice.
If the state police were manning the post, would the possibility of longer hours be more likely?
It is, but I think that's the wrong approach to the problem. For example, the conviction rate at a fixed station is something like 1.62. The arrest
for what?
Percent per
number of trucks that go through the station.
Yes. The arrest rate on jump scales is running about 5.5 or 3.5 times as much. You know, it's obvious that if you've got a surprise situation operated by a competent law enforcement officer, you're going to be able to track the violations better. The other thing is that the Waymaster operation was set up, you know, for a log truck industry 35 years ago, and essentially, with some changes, still that. But the big traffic is in Portland. It's a known fact that trucks come into Washington from Portland, overloaded, heavily overloaded, dump the main part of their load in Portland and travel out of Portland legal limits, because there are no way stations in the Portland area, no fixed stations. And the use of jump scales is almost non-existent. Part of the reason is an operational one. You just can't stop 4,000 trucks a day coming across an interstate bridge and keep traffic moving. But there are ways to get around this.
They're ruining Washington's highways, not Oregon.
Sure. Some of that.
I would kind of like an excellent book, an explanation of this. Page 48, you've got one thing, number of sightings. What is this number of sightings?
Well, those are PUC sightings where the state police will cite a carrier that they suspect is in violation of some kind, safety violation, an overlength, overload, whatever. And they turn this information over to PUC, and then PUC has the information to follow on an audit basis.
I noticed that this has dropped from 30,065 to 10,069. Do you have an explanation for that?
Well, I'm trying to.
Always seems to happen.
What is it?
Sir?
Yeah, the PUC about that time, the PUC department indicated that they didn't want, we call those stew pigeon reports. Stew pigeon reports. The officer jots down a truck at a certain location, and if he can see the load, he jots the load down. He doesn't stop the truck at all. He might be passing it on the highway, the truck might be in front of him. He has a pad along in his seat beside him, he jots these things down with pencil. And they indicated that certain types of trucks about that time, it didn't do them any good anymore, common carrier type and that sort of thing. What they use them for is they're sending great bundles into the auditors, and they use them when they're auditing private carrier trucks who are on the percent per mile basis. And if the man says he wasn't in that area at that particular time, he takes a stew pigeon out and shows him. And actually, they gather quite a few fees that way. That was the purpose of these things, and we can write those things for the run out of their ears if they want them, but I think we're doing about what they thought they wanted at that time.
They requested you not to send so many reports.
Well, there are certain types of trucks.
Thank you. Are there any more questions, Mr. Payne? afraid, since you're a loan executive to the state government, a considerable expense to your company, I think we should get a plug in. What company do you represent?
IBM.
Thank you.
Did you print these sheets?
Mr. Chairman, just one additional comment. I think it's on its own merit alone, it's fine to talk about the necessity for effective law enforcement. We've been told by a number of members of the trucking industry that an honest trucker has no fear, but is the beneficiary of effective law enforcement. But to add a little frosting to the cake, there are a significant amount of revenue involved as a result of this kind of activity. And we feel that not only will we have a better level of enforcement from this transfer, but the state will collect, and I can't give you a figure, but I would suggest well into the millions of dollars of additional revenue as a result of more effective enforcement.
Thank you, Ken. Is there anybody from the Waymaster side who would like to testify to the gentleman? Anybody want to talk about anything?
State and Federal Affairs Subcommittee on Governmental Reorganization meeting Friday, February 12th, 1 p.m. Hearings on HB 1058 and HB 1059.
Prepared a number of amendments to 1058 to go over. My only comment is that these speak to the recommendations that were made by the various state agency administrators, do not speak to the question of the part of the bill that relates to education.
The First Amendment, page 2, line 5, is to the title, and I would like to defer to that until we get further down. Page 2, lines 29 and 30, this is a deletion of lines of paragraph F, which duplicates language found at the on 18 and 19 of the same page. Page 2, line 31, inserting language which makes it clear that the department rules and regulations would have to be promulgated in accordance with the Administrative Procedures Act, which involves hearings and the right of appeal from anyone adversely affected. Page 3, line 2, is the suggested language which would give the director the powers of a law enforcement officer. Out his duties under this act. There might be occasions when the director might, in carrying out his duties, be in a situation where he would have to make an arrest, for example. And this would give him the powers of a peace officer doing that. Page 3, line 12, makes it clear that the deputy director continues to serve as the divisional administrator of his respective division while he is serving as deputy director. Page 3, line 14, gives the deputy director peace officer powers while acting for the director in the director's absence.
You wouldn't have him otherwise?
Not under this suggested language. He might if, for example, let's assume the director appointed the superintendent of state police as deputy director. Well, obviously, he would have peace officer powers at all times. But it might be that he would appoint, let's say, the adjutant general. The adjutant general would not have peace officer powers unless the director was absent and the adjutant general was acting as director of public safety. I would not be adverse, Mr. Chairman, to giving the deputy director peace officer powers at all times.
I don't have any trouble envisioning anybody but the superintendent of state police as deputy director. That might happen. And I think he should have police powers. Of course, you can make a citizen's arrest.
Well, yes, you can always make a citizen's arrest, but you have to be right.
You mean a peace officer doesn't always
act? Peace officer can act, is freer to act on reasonable cause without subjecting himself to a suit. I'm sure that the executive department certainly would have no objection if the committee wanted to make these powers.
Lee, do you have any objections to giving in police powers? What is it?
Drop out those first five words and capitalize. Page 3, lines 29 and 30, simply technical verbiage here, which makes it clear that the administrators are in exempt service, which is a technical word, really. It doesn't change the substance at all. Page 4, line 24, delete the reference to 181050. Again, I will. I might as well take up the reason for this. As the bill now stands, the duties of the governor under 181050 would be transferred to the director of public safety. 181050 authorizes the state police, with the approval of the governor, to be called on by any other department of the government to enforce criminal laws applicable or pertaining to such department or any regulation of such department. Now, all the other sections enumerated here in Section 6 of the bill are interdepartmental functions. This one, on the contrary, involves something that the Department of Public Safety would do vis-a-vis other departments of the government of the state. And it seems appropriate here that before the director proceeds to authorize the state police to enforce these other criminal laws, that he should obtain some clearance from the governor himself. Now, I also broaden the language a little bit here when I, instead of saying another department of state government, I said that any branch or agency of the state of Oregon. This would, I think, authorize, would cover the legislative assembly and the court, as well as agencies within the executive department, and might very well solve a problem that now exists as to legislative security, because it would give the state police authority to provide legislative security officers without any other statute or without a ceremony of having them appointed sergeants at arms. Now, going back, if I may, to page 5, line 9, superintendent of the state police suggested some language in section 8 of the bill. He suggested, first of all, that his term be specified as a 4-year term, which is no change from the present, it is now. And on page 5, that's on page 5, line 9. On page 5, line 10, he suggested that the words regarding removal at any time for cause be changed to read, for inefficiency or malfeasance in office, after charges have been filed and a hearing, if requested, has been held before the governor or an officer appointed by him.
That's a change in present law, though.
No, sir, that's essentially what the present law is. He must have an opportunity for a hearing before he's removed, and the removal must be for inefficiency or malfeasance in office. So this, in a sense, is restoring Section 8 to the present situation.
Is there any objection to that, please?
The superintendent believes this would he's not worried about the present incumbent by any means, but he believes it would afford greater protection of the state police from possible political appointments. The Section 10A on page 5, line 32 is the amendment to 181050 that I just discussed. Page 6, there are some amendments here in lines 14 and 15. This carries out the recommendation of the superintendent of state police that a member of the Board on Police Standards and Training shall be a member of the Oregon State Police, in addition to a member who's a city policeman and another one who's a county deputy sheriff.
Somebody's just an FBI member.
Actually, there is a member of the state police who currently is a member of the board. Major Hazelton is now a member of the board. This is simply by law continuing this arrangement. Page 7, line 24, is a technical change. In section 14, it states that the Department of Public Safety succeeds to and is vested with the duties, functions, and powers vested in the state military department. There might be some legal objection raised to the ability of the Department of Public Safety as such to succeed to these powers, which involve a certain amount of connection with the federal establishment. These amendments are intended to resolve any question by making it plain that it's the military division of the Department of Public Safety that succeeds to the functions of the present military department. And I'm authorized to say that the Adjutant General approves of and urges this particular amendment. On page, I'm going to...
No, I have no.
You'll hear.
On page 20, the final amendment, page 20 of the bill, line 21, section dealing with waymasters. As it's presently worded in the bill, section 34 would say that any person duly authorized as a waymaster by the Oregon State Police or any county waymaster in whose presence is violated any provision of the overloading statute may proceed under the Uniform Traffic Citation Law in the same manner as if he were a police officer. Now, the proposed amendment here, the last three lines on page 2 of the draft, would add some additional duties here besides overloading. Chapter 482 relates to motor vehicle licensing and driver licensing. ORS 483-402 to 483-495 relates to motor vehicle equipment, headlights, taillights, reflectors, that sort of thing. And ORS Chapter 767 is the public utility, the motor carrier law. In effect, in addition to issuing citations for overloading violations, the waymasters under this amendment would be able to issue citations for other non-moving types of motor vehicle offenses, the ones that are specified here. That's the motor carrier law. Motor carrier.
Now, the state police believe that the present waymaster has emotionally, physically, and enforce these laws.
Well, I discussed this at some length with the superintendent. The superintendent, quite frankly, doubts whether they would be able to do anything very effectively against moving violations.
Well, you're not involved with moving violations.
No, but he does believe that with some additional training and perhaps the process of attrition and additional recruitment, and within a reasonably short time, they could be brought into a position whereby they could enforce other types of non-moving violations.
How do we make these people full-fledged state policemen without firing a lot of people?
Well, they wouldn't be full-fledged state policemen, as I understand the arrangement. They would not become members of... They might become members, perhaps, of the Department of State Police. But the Department of State Police does not consist entirely of state police officers. Are also administrative personnel. It's also possible that they might be established as a separate unit within the Department of Public Safety under the guidance of the Superintendent of State Police. But it would not be, I believe, anyone's intention to make them full-fledged state police officers with full powers of arrest and all that.
Mr. Chairman, through attrition, all of these jobs we know by full-fledged state police.
Over 45, and that's what a major majority of them. I don't, I
call percentage, but the majority of them are older.
You take them off the road for
45.
Mine's already on the way.
Oh, it's not introduced.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm moving it off of the menu. While acting for the director on the amendment, page 3, line 14, capitalizing the T.
Roger. There is a bill that goes along with the 18-year-old vote, which would make the majority of it. Is that in another section of the committee, or is that?
I think it's here. On what? I have a room full of students over there. I want to hear something else.
Okay. You read the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary minded?
Carried.
Okay, now we're by no means through with this bill. This is the amendment that we suggested today. And then further comments on the way match we have scheduled for when?
You were going to set a date for some educators, as I recall, wanted to.
Yeah. Are you going to testify on this?
I had one to testify on, but I didn't want to hold the capping.
Well, we kind of like know that too, so don't feel the dark.
Oh, I was concerned about this question. The education department is going to testify.
I just remembered that.
And you'd be very welcome to come in and testify at that time.
Thank you.
Okay, is anybody else here on 1058? Okay, that closes the hearing on that. The next hearing is Mr. Lee Johnson on 1272.
Yeah. You want me to go take the stand?
Yeah, I want you to feel comfortable. Where are they?
He wasn't there, but he'd be up.
It's a very important bill. I was asked by our Jackson County Court and the City of Medford to introduce this bill that would allow Jackson County and the city jointly to acquire control of the Oddfellow Cemetery in Medford. The reason that the legislature has to give us approval, I could find no ORS statute, but the legislature does have to approve the acquisition, as so stated in this bill. This was done right here in Marion County within Salem. The legislature approved, I believe, the city of Salem taking over a cemetery here in Marion County that was about, that was experiencing financial difficulty and they were going to have to abandon. This is in essence what has happened in Medford. The Oddfellow Cemetery is in dire financial straits. They've asked the City of Ashland and the Jackson County Court to take over the cemetery, and they have agreed to do so if this piece of legislation passes. In essence, that's about it. It's kind of a housekeeping measure for Jackson County. It costs the state no money in any way. Mr. Candy, go ahead.
People in my district are very sensitive about it. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's what
they may think it will affect our situation. Jackson County, the city members just don't have any intention of moving the cemetery to some other location.
Not to my knowledge. I think that their main thought is that they're able to maintain the cemetery in reasonable fashion and provide the remaining plots to the use of people and see that it's well taken care of.
Acquire, own, control, operate, maintain, care for, preserve, protect. storms.
Is it in pretty bad shape now?
It's in bad shape.
They're going to restore the grave, it says in here.
We've had a little trouble with vandalism in the cemetery.
Is the skeleton missing? In the closet someplace? Or...
not to my knowledge, Mr. Chairman.
But have you already voted?
I'm
Would you like to take your seat so we can have a forum?
Apparently, I'll vote for
him. I'll accept the motion.
We send the bill to the full committee with a recommendation. Do pass.
This committee has moved the House Bill 1272 be sent to the full state federal affairs committee with a recommendation to pass. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
And well, how legal this is. That's kind of House Bill 1275 authorizes the session of the legislative assembly to be convened by joint resolution to consider matters specified in convening resolution or to be convened upon written request of majority members of each House. Specify the final adjournment, the constitution of statutory session be determined the effective date of enactment for that session. For all intents and purposes, this is exactly the same thing that the people turned down on the ballot. And I think, are there some more bills that you know of to this effect? Or are more? Well, this allows the legislature to call itself back into session. Majority vote of the members of each House. Government has a sponsor.
Well, wait just a minute.
You might get your day.
Wait just a minute. I haven't even found it yet.
1275. I'm just trying to kick some of these housekeeping bills. Do you want to do anything on 18-year-old vote today? You want to kick it out? Or do you want to have a
vote? Oh, it is barely
done. Send your vote, please.
I don't know. Maybe
this. You're doing this test for me?
Yeah. We have in the Senate or
SJR
Senate.
It's
wearing
the blue
part. Well, it is in the Senate. It's called Senator. Room 20 session on this one. What happened in the Senate? Are you aware?
I think we ought to have a hearing on it.
I do too.
Okay, we'll schedule that for when. I think we want this one out.
Let's.
Is it Wednesday?
Wednesday.
You want to put on Monday instead?
No, I'll do it a week from Wednesday.
Okay. Chairman, in connection with a hearing on this, I would like to hear some. A detailed testimony from the Secretary of State's office. Secretary of State's office. Concerning the problems that they think will result from the Supreme Court from an 18-year-old voter national election.
I'd also like to have some financial figures, too.
Yeah.
Okay, and invite all the people to sign the joint resolution. And see if you can find the concurrent bill that goes with this thing that makes, if it passes, it makes
We don't have it in the state federal.
Oh, I don't find it either. I'm not, I just thought it was here, but I don't find it.
It
makes the, gives the majority rights if this passes, and if that's our bill,
if we just got it last night or today, and I'll look and I do it.
$1,162, what's that?
State and Federal Affairs Subcommittee on Governmental Reorganization meeting Monday, February 15, 1971, 1:30 p.m., room 106B. On House Bill 1282 and House Bill 1291.
And the bill is 1291.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the subject matter of this bill came to my attention as a result of a telephone call that we knew Lee and Senator Roberts one night when we were at home from an Oregon contractor who was bidding on a job up in the state of Washington. He was interested in getting the job and had received, it was a public job, and he had received the bid forms and that sort of thing. And together with the bid forms, he received a copy of a Washington statute. And the Washington statute said, in the same words as this statute says, that on all public jobs in the state of Washington, the contractor has to agree to employ 95% or more of Washington residents, where more than 50 persons are employed, and 90% or more were 50 or more were less than 50 people are employed. He said that he had bid on jobs previously in the state of Washington and had never been threatened with this statute, and he wanted to know whether it was something new or what had happened and or what the situation was. So we investigated the matter. And I talked with Mr. Kalinowski, who represents the contractors group, and I talked with Mr. Whalen, who represents the Oregon AFL-CIO, and they said that this statute had been in effect in the state of Washington for many years, and that it had never been enforced until relatively recently, and now because of the threat of economic affairs in the state of Washington, both the contractors and the labor and the union are insisting that all the Washington residents be employed on Washington's dock. Now, this particular bill is an attempt to get Washington to repeal its law. We have a lot of workmen, a lot of union people, a lot of contractors in Portland who do work up in the state of Washington and have done work in the state of Washington, and Washington has kept their wink at the provisions of this act. But if they're going to enforce it, I don't like to see what we call retaliatory legislation, and that's what that is. But if they're going to enforce theirs, then I suggest that Oregon is in a position today with its economy to be in a very competitive position as far as the state of Washington. And what I'd like to see the committee do is hold the bill for the time being until we can see whether we get some repeal legislation out of the Washington legislature. If we don't, then I think we ought to pass it. I would like to have the committee have some further testimony from organized labor on the issue to see whether or not they feel it might injure any of those first people in the state of Oregon. But at the present time, at least I haven't heard any comments adversely from these members of organized labor. I don't know if Mr. Kalinowski has signed up to discuss the bill in the AGC, and he says that he's against the bill, and I don't know why. Yes, but we'll find out.
Are there any questions?
questions, Mr. Kelton?
Keith, if this passes the committee and goes to the floor, would you carry it on the floor?
Yes.
Is the AFL CIO ready to testify in this bill, one way or the other? Okay, if there's no more questions, Keith. If the other people here will excuse us just a moment while we have Representative Skelton here, I'd like to ask him to testify on another bill on which will come before us very soon. It's 1275. And maybe Keith ought to have a copy of it.
Can I get a copy?
House Bill 1275 is a device that will provide that the state legislature can call itself into session. As everyone on the committee knows, the proposed new constitution, which was presented to the people last time, had a provision which would have allowed this. In addition, there was another single amendment to the constitution, which was presented to the people, which would have allowed this, and both of them were defeated. Basically, I think the reason why they were defeated is because they were misunderstood. We didn't have anybody, at least the single amendment, didn't have anybody pushing it, didn't have anyone explaining it, and I think that it was simply a misunderstood measure. Now, this will provide in subsection 1 that upon adoption of a joint resolution, passed by a majority of the members of each house, the legislature can call itself under this session. And subsection 2 provides that by action of the presiding officers of both houses on written request of the majority of members elected to each house. The first section applies to action which would be taken while we were in session. The second section applies to action which would be taken when we are out of session. And we decided the majority of people in each house decided that we should go into session. The section 2, the final adjournment shall constitute the end of the session. The reason why this is necessary is because of the peculiar provisions of our constitution, which says that tax matters shall not go into effect for 90 days after final adjournment. And so you have to set a time somewhere or another where this 90 days starts to run. I don't know where my other bill on this subject is, Mr. Chairman, but there's another bill very similar to this that I have also sponsored, which is floating around someplace. And it provides for this too. Now, what you can do under this thing is that you can have a final adjournment and continue right on in your session. In other words, if we desire to do so, we could adjourn tomorrow for 5 minutes and then come back into session. That would be the final adjournment, which is necessary under the Constitution in order to cut back the time running for tax measures. And you can set the final adjournment at any time and then just simply continue on the session. The nice thing about this thing is the elasticity of it and the fact that it does, by statute, make the legislature into a co-equal third body. I think it's if I were to have my druthers about any piece of legislation that would assist the legislative assembly in this session, this kind of legislation, I think is the most vital legislation that we have.
providing this is passed, would be referred.
If I'm not mistaken, one of the places that the Oregon Assembly got marked down on their report card was the fact that they couldn't call themselves back into session. Yes. That's what, correct.
Of course. This is a terrible thing. Congress solved this problem a long time ago. At the beginning of the United States, the history of the United States, the Congress didn't have the power to call itself into session. Many years ago, in the late 1700s, they just simply passed a statute on the matter and solved the problem. And we've been fooling around and saying to each other, oh, we can't do this, we need a constitutional amendment and all that sort of thing. I think that's a lot of nonsense. And we want to be told very, very simply by this statute. Mr. Johnson is saying, I hope that this doesn't get buried in this
case. Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. We'll return to 1291. Jack Kalinowski.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Kalinowski, and I'm representing the Oregon Columbia Chapter of the Association of Contractors. I did sign up to testify relative to House Bill 1291 in opposition to the bill, although I do so somewhat with tongue-in-cheek. I understand, and I consulted with Representative Skelton before the bill was drafted and introduced, the problems that have resulted with Oregon contractors who are working in Washington and incidentally also Idaho, where statutes exist that require bona fide Washington or Idaho residents on public contracts. However, let me put it this way. On January 26th, last month, Governor McCall, at our request, directed a letter to Governor Evans asking for consideration of the repeal of this section of Title 39 of the Washington Code. And we've been waiting to see if Governor Evans could somehow or other encourage the Washington legislature, which is also in session, to accommodate that request. I made a telephone call this morning to a friend of mine who happens to be in the state senate in the state of Washington to inquire whether such a bill had been introduced as of this morning. The answer was negative. Governor McCall's office has yet to receive an answer from Governor Evans, and the situation right now, right at this moment, is that a bill has not been introduced, and Governor Evans, there's no indication that Governor Evans has reacted. However, the senator that I did talk to, Senator Geff, G-E-F-F, assured me that as soon as our telephone conversation was completed, he would have their bill drafters prepare a measure for his introduction, which would repeal the section. On the basis of this, it would be my suggestion that you hold on to House Bill 1291 until we can see the effects of Senator Geff's measure in the state of Washington. I would, however, encourage you to remember that the construction industry is a highly mobile industry. Contractors will move from place to place throughout the Northwest and into at least the northern part of California and Nevada, taking with them their key men. And one of the things, I suppose, that would concern our industry is if Oregon should follow the lead that's been set by the state of Washington, the state of Idaho, we might find the same thing in all the other states also. And I hardly think that this is the kind of a situation that we want to see any segment of our industry operating under. You might be interested in a little story, I suppose, about a Washington contractor who went into Idaho in a town over there, bid and got a job to construct sidewalks for a city. The contractor was required to comply with this kind of legislation. He did not choose to do so, and he was thrown in jail for violation of this kind of statute. Now, this particular contractor was, I'm told, pouring sidewalks in an extruding machine that he had developed for the cost of $1 a million a foot, meeting the city's specifications, and the next lowest bid was $3 a lineal foot. He was employing three people who were bona fide residents of the state of Washington while doing an Idaho contract, and it's kind of funny to figure how you can get 95% of three people working on a contract with that kind of specialization. At any rate, I don't know how this particular contract will resolve the problem, but at any rate, I hope you will accept Representative Johnson's suggestion that this bill be held in advance for a while.
I'm a little bit confused how you and Mr. Skelton can testify on the same bill, one for and one against, and come up with the same recommendation.
Well, easy.
But we'll accept it. Thank you, Jack. Mm-hmm. Any questions of Mr. Skelton? Whalen?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Whalen, representing Oregon AFL-CIO. I don't know whether I'm for or against it, but I don't agree with the conclusions reached by either Representative Skelton or Mr. Kalamansky. Having had some experience with the Washington legislature and their reluctance to do anything, past experience has shown the Oregon legislature that the best way to get them to react to a given situation is the passing legislation such as this, which is certainly not desirable, through one house of the body, because the Olympia papers immediately pick it up and then they get on the ball and do something about correcting something in their statutory provisions that's detrimental to Oregon residents. The most recent example I can think of was a Workman's Comp-Reciprocity Bill, which the Associated General Contractors in our organization have been trying for years. Well, while still a member of this body, I introduced a bill removing the standard exemption for Washington employees who are employed in Oregon. As far as their tax status is concerned, we passed it through one house, and within 48 hours, we got a reciprocity bill through the Washington legislature. And then we had a bad time here turning off the bill as we started moving. But if they are going, this statute has been on the books for years in Washington. Apparently only recently have they been enforcing it. And this is what I think Senator Governor McCall's letter to Governor Evans. And you might want to consider the possibility of passing this through there, passing it from your committee, for the publicity that might accrue to it, and get the message across the river so that they will do something about repealing their statute. Because we run into a conflict, I know Jack's contractors do, where they have a job on the border, on the county border in the Columbia River, especially, where practically all the manpower for these jobs necessarily comes out of Oregon, because the population centers along the Columbia are on the Oregon side. And manning these major jobs, even though they might be public jobs within the jurisdiction of the state of Washington or its political subdivision, manning does become a problem. And if they try to invoke this, it's detrimental to the contractor and time and expenses that he's got tied up. A man thinks he has a job and suddenly hasn't got a job, so he goes back into the pool in the Oregon market. This type of legislation, restrictive stuff of this nature, is very detrimental to the workforce. I hope that we don't pass this bill, but I'd like to see it pass through one house for the purposes of that. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Whalen, can you guarantee if the House passes this, the Senate won't?
No, I can't. We hope it's, if it does, maybe the governor might be there.
Can you guarantee that?
No, I can't guarantee anything. But I think that if it's desirable to have the Washington law repealed, you've got to do something more than just have a hearing on this bill.
Lee? Yes. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll close the hearings on 12. Anybody else speak to this bill?
No.
Okay, we'll close the hearing on 1291 and open the hearing on 1282. Everett Stiles, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Everett Stiles of the Oregon State Employees Association. House Bill 1282 would require that the State Personnel Administrator investigate complaints that were brought to his office on charges of action, personnel action being either arbitrary or taken contrary to law. Upon investigating and arriving at a decision, it would authorize the personnel administrator to issue an order which would be binding upon the agency to which this order was given. I'd like to go back and refer a little bit to past history, what took place in the 1969 legislative session. At that time, the Civil Service Commission was divided into two agencies. One was the Personnel Division, which was to be the arm of management, was to provide the personnel management services for the state of Oregon, and the second agency, the Public Employer Relations Board, which was to take over the appellate functions of the old Civil Service Commission, as well as be the body that supervised the public employee collective bargaining statute. At the time the Personnel Division was implemented and took being and became into existence, the civil service rules were in existence, and they were the rules under which the state employees operated for approximately a year's time until the new Personnel Division promulgated new rules. With the new agency and the promulgation of new rules, there came a much greater involvement of that agency in the personnel administration of the state of Oregon, as the legislature had contemplated and as the employees had contemplated. In the rules that were promulgated by that division, they initiated two new rules which were not contained prior to that time in the old Civil Service Commission. One of these rules was that the administrator shall investigate any charges, such as these that are referred to in this House bill, that he shall investigate these upon being brought to him. The other rule was that for every agency, they must have a grievance procedure. Now, this had existed in the past. However, each agency in their grievance procedure must provide for a review of that procedure by the State Personnel Division. Now, this has been complied with in nearly all agencies. The agencies have established grievance procedures. As part of that procedure, they have provided that the Personnel Division has a review. In our collective bargaining contract, which today exists in approximately 42 state agencies, we have provided further review in two sections of our contract by the State Personnel Division. It's our opinion that grievances and employee relations problems should be solved at the lowest possible level. They cannot be resolved within the agency itself. They should then be taken to the Personnel Division for attempts at resolvement, and only at the last possible course should they be appealed to the Public Employee Relations Board. Personnel Division, in their budget hearings and Ways and Means Committee this morning, indicated that their involvement in the personnel management function had become much more exhaustive than they had ever anticipated, that they are being called upon numerous times to review grievances and grievance hearings that have taken place in the agency. An example of one of these might have been a case that took place about 6 months ago
in one of our larger state agencies. An employee was laid off the payroll and his job was then contracted out by the employer. We, at that time, asked the personnel division to investigate as the rules provided. They investigated and found that the layoff had been taken contrary to the law. However, in instructing this large state agency, they had no authority to rescind the action of that agency. The agency went on their way, they continued to sustain their action, and we appealed this particular case to the Public Employee Relations Board. Some 90 days later, the Public Employee Relations Board overruled the decision of the appointing authority. They sustained the action that the personnel division had suggested that this agency take. By so doing, the employee was reinstated. He was paid back pay to the tune of approximately 5 months, during which time he had not been employed or not worked for the state, but he was paid for that period of time because the action taken was contrary to the law. Now, the personnel division, had they had the authority of this bill, this is the decision they had arrived at 5 months prior. Yet they do not have this authority today. I'm given to believe that they are going to testify in opposition to this bill today, that although they talk of the total involvement that they want with the state's agency, they want to run a viable personnel administration program, yet they don't want the authority that goes along with it and the responsibility of forcing decisions and not making or allowing those decisions to be appealed by the agency over which they might place some order. I think that the record would show, if you were to talk to any of your fellow legislators in the Ways and Means Committee, that the personnel division is getting very involved in these grievance problems. Yet, at this time, and if legislation such as this is not passed, they are purely going to be in an advisory capacity, not in a true management capacity, as the legislature, I believe, contemplated them in their foundation in 1969.
Are there questions, Mr. Stiles?
Does the personnel division handle all of these such grievances for all the agencies? Is that their prime function?
Presently, one section of the personnel division is their employee relations section. In the new personnel division rules that were promulgated on, I believe, June 1st of 1970, there's a rule that says that all agencies must provide for a review of their grievance procedures by the state personnel division. Now, we, as well as this rule, have included in every collective bargaining contract that OSEA has with a state agency for a review by the state personnel division prior to any appeal going to the Public Employee Relations Board.
Okay, I guess no more questions. Same subject, William Hughes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Hughes, the Administrator of Personnel Division. Although I can appreciate the motive behind this bill, I'm concerned about the procedure for carrying it out and some of the basic philosophies suggested by it. All of us involved in personnel management share one common goal, to resolve each grievance at its lowest possible level. By doing this, we get the matter taken care of, and we get back on the job, and we prevent the problems from becoming larger. Grievances can be real or imaginary, expressed or unexpressed, but in every case, they're extremely important to the employee at the time that he has them. They seldom go away or resolve themselves when ignored by management. Therefore, it's good employee relations and it's good management to seek out grievances, identify their causes, decide on what means should be taken to resolve them, and apply those solutions promptly. Now, under our present system, each agency has a formal grievance procedure, which is used to handle complaints. The process always starts by attempting to solve the problem with the employee's immediate supervisor, in other words, at the first level. In most cases, the matter is resolved at this point.
through the simple process of the supervisor sitting down and talking it over with the employee. In those cases where it can't be resolved, the problem is passed on to the next higher level of authority. Normally at this stage, the problem is expressed in writing and takes on a more formal appearance. There is usually a time limit for each level to respond to the problem. Staff of the personnel division may be called into the discussions at any time to assist the agency with consultation and rule implementation. In all cases, if the agency cannot resolve the problem, the personnel division is formally brought into the case as the last step in the grievance procedure. We investigate the grievance, interview primary parties involved, inspect records, examine other evidence, and evaluate the situation. After a review, considering the various alternatives for handling the case, we render a decision to the agency and the employee. If either the employee or the agency does not agree with the decision, and it concerns a question which is arbitrary, contrary to rule or law, or for political reason, the matter can be appealed to the Public Employees Relations Board for formal hearing. Now, this bill attempts to expedite the grievance handling by granting greater express authority to the personnel administrator. It would cause his decision to be binding to the agency, but not to the employee. However, it is subject to a number of questions in its present form, and we'd like to bring those to your attention. The first question raised by this proposal is whether or not it is appropriate to empower the personnel division with the authority to veto the discretionary determination of an individual appointing authority. The report of the Legislative Fiscal Committee to the 55th Legislative Assembly, published in December 1968, states that the duties of the personnel division should not include the review or quasi-judicial functions of the previously functioning school service commission. It was determined that management should be released from the role of protector, guardian, and decider of the public interest, so that management could place greater emphasis on personnel administration. The purpose of the legislation was to remove the personnel division from the contradictory role of passing judgment on its own advice. At the same time, allow them to act in a staff function as an advisor and a consultant to the various agencies. This position would seem to raise a second question as to whether or not this proposal would duplicate and perhaps even supersede the position of the Employee Relations Board. If so, one can assume that a formal hearing with its necessity for specific investigation of facts would introduce added costs and manpower requirements. And in spite of this investigation and formal hearing, the employee still would have a right to appeal to a board in another formal hearing. A third consideration, which we feel warrants evaluation, is that the appointing authority would be denied the right of appeal from any determination of administration. The employee, however, is not so restricted. It would appear vastly more equitable and in keeping with the principles of a bilateral employee-employer relationship if both parties to the dispute were afforded equal rights to appeal. Finally, the language of this bill provides that the administrator may hold a hearing. This bill does not indicate whether this hearing should be under the Administrative Procedures Act. Under the provisions of ORS 183.310, the personnel division is subject to the Administrative Procedures Act. This then would imply that the formality of ORS 183 would be required. Currently, this would mean, among other things, that any employee who appeals an action to a hearing would be able to represent himself or could select someone else of his choice to represent him. The courts have determined that this would require such an appointed representative to be an attorney. The trend stemming from this requirement has been an increased concern for the legal point of an appeal, with a corresponding decrease in consideration for the merits of the case. This element of concern becomes doubly significant in view of the plan to further restrict qualifications related to public hearings
under the Administrative Procedures Act. In conclusion, we might say that the current system for handling appeals in the grievance process is new, less than 2 years old. The objective of the change was to separate the management responsibilities from the quasi-judicial review previously handled by civil service. A strict interpretation of this bill suggests a move backwards to the previous role of the Civil Service Commission. We don't think the experience of the past year and a half supports the need for such a change.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Are there questions, Mr. Hughes?
Mr. Stiles, I have one example where a person was laid off and received back pay. My understanding is you recommended that they had acted illegally.
In that particular case, the department had contracted to have custodial work performed and then laid off the employee. In our review of the case, we indicated to that department that we did not feel it was a good practice to do what they did, that it would be much better had they placed that employee in another job and then contracted out rather than to cause a layoff. We wrote to them in a formal manner, such as the final step of the grievance procedure suggests. We said we did not agree with what they did. And they, in fact, replied, we don't agree with you. And so then the matter went to the Public Employees Relations Board for the decision.
Generally, that much time lag? And this took 5 months. Does a normal grievance take 5 months to go to?
No, it varies, however, with the case. I think in this particular case, and I don't think it's a good example because I think it's an exception to the normal grievance, but in this particular case, the legal advisors for the agency felt that they had the right understanding of the problem, and our legal advisors had a different opinion, and it became a technical point, really, more than a philosophical point, and the Public Employees Relations Board had to answer to that technical point.
How many, are you overruled by agencies in terms of your recommendations on?
No, we would begin to lose our confidence, I'm afraid, if we were. These instances that we were trying to count up when we heard of this bill, I think there's been two or three during the past year where the agency didn't agree with it. Considering the number of complaints we have every day now, running something like 4 or 5 today, I think we have a fairly good record.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Mr. Underdahl.
Mr. Chairman, I hadn't prepared to make any particular comments on it, except I would offer one suggestion in light of Mr. Urban Kennedy's question.
Will you introduce yourself?
For the record, I'm Ken Underdahl, Deputy Director of the Executive Department. As Mr. Hughes has commented, we feel that much of the intent of the bill is a matter of current administrative practice, and that there is a consciousness and an effort made to resolve grievances at the appropriate level. And in fact, we feel that this particular action provides no new policy direction that isn't implemented largely under current procedures. I would observe, answering by Representative Kennedy's question, that the tendency of this law, if it became enacted, would in all probability tend to slow down the appeals process by leaving in a formal additional step of review. Philosophically, I'm concerned, as was the 69 legislature, about having the personnel division play a schizoid role in trying to be judge and jury of its own actions as a counselor of state agencies in the manner of which they administer their personnel practices.
Any questions? Thank you, Ken. Is there anybody else to be heard on 1282? Would you like a rebuttal?
Can the two spoke first?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would. I think I would take exception to the statement that we feel that this would be a step backwards. I do not believe this would be a step backwards. Those of you who were here in 1969 will recall that OSCA supported the move to the separation of the two agencies from the Old Food Service Commission. We feel that this would be placing with the Executive Department and the Personnel Division a little more authority that they do not have today. I do not believe this case I cited was an exception. I would refer to some charts shown this morning in the Ways and Means Committee on two examples that were brought before that committee. It took a year and a half to solve grievances. Now, maybe 5 months, I shook my head that was a long period of time, and I personally believe that is a long period of time to settle any grievance. That grievances should be solved at the earliest possible time. And what we would proposed in Hospital 1282 is that the Personnel Division does have this authority when an agency does not agree with it to impose their decision on the agency. It would not happen in many instances. In most instances, the agencies have complied with the personnel decision, and it has not been a directive. But in the instances where they have not complied, it has necessitated going on into an appeal, and I don't know how many of those we've won or the agency's won, but it is a time-consuming process, something over which the personnel division does have this expertise. This is part of their function as within their section of employee relations to be able to direct agencies in personnel matters.
Thank you. Anybody else? Have anything to say on this subject? We have quite an audience, and not everybody makes themselves heard. Do you want to talk about any other bill?
Me, adjourned.